Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
If you want to succeed in this line of work, you need to be willing to bend the rules.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the White House Plumbers podcast, the official audio companion to the HBO limited series that explores the Watergate scandal through the eyes of the people who actually carried it out. My name is Olivia Nuzzi, and I'm the Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Let's just get this out of the way. D.C. is a really weird city. Some people say it's like a small town. Everyone seems to either be in politics or, like me, covering it. And you run into the same people everywhere you go. But most importantly, there's always a room. If you're not in that room, then you're probably near it or you're trying to get a peek inside of it. In this podcast, my goal is to give you a little bit of that peek inside. Over 5 episodes, I'll be your bridge to understanding on a deeper level the White House Plumbers. That's both the people and the limited series. I'll delve into some of the show's most memorable moments, and we'll unpack just how historically accurate they really are. As a political journalist, I often find myself in situations where I cannot believe that what is happening. I think we all do these days. So I felt right at home watching this series. In this opening episode, we meet E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, an ex-CIA and ex-FBI officer who are recruited by the White House to investigate the Pentagon Papers leak. Hunt and Liddy's idea is to don costumes, break into a psychiatrist's office, and photograph a bunch of medical documents to find some dirt on Daniel Ellsberg, who was behind the leak.
There's that, but that one's locked too.
Break the goddamn window.
It does not exactly go according to plan.
Feelings out of pocket.
What?
We have to get the boys out.
Why didn't you radio me?
Fellas, can you hear me?
That's why! Ow!
But let's put a pause on Hunt and Liddy's antics for just a minute. I want to talk about why White House Plumbers, the limited series, got made, and the origin story starts around 2012 in an unexpected place. The supermarket.
I would eat at Whole Foods every night.
This is Dave Bernad, a Hollywood producer. He's the guy behind TV shows like Enlightened and The White Lotus. Bernad was living in Los Angeles, and many evenings he had a routine. He'd go to the Whole Foods salad bar, pile up his plate, and, like a good son, he'd call his dad.
My dad, he's a Hungarian immigrant, and my grandparents are all Holocaust survivors, and I feel like because of that, I think they put pressure on him to kind of live a more traditional life. And my dad ended up putting himself through medical school and becoming a neurologist. But I think he always had this like artistic flair to him. And because of the way he grew up, I think he never was able to kind of explore that artistic side. So for years, my dad has been pitching me ideas, different Hollywood ideas.
Bernad said that he would humor his dad. He'd listen to all his suggestions. But there was one idea that his dad would just not let go of.
He had a patient named Bud Crowe. My dad had been his doctor for many years, and for at least 3 or 4 years, he'd been pitching me this idea about doing a show about Watergate. I'd go to Whole Foods, the salad bar, and I'd put him on mute, and my dad, for 20 minutes, would just go on this long rant about Bud Crowe and Watergate and Nixon and the White House plumbers, and he would go on and on and on, and I would never take him seriously. And to my dad's credit, he was kind of relentless with me about it. So I eventually said to him, okay, I'll come meet Bud. And it was really just to shut him up.
Bernad was working on a show that was shooting in Montreal at the time. So on his way to Canada one day, he routed his flight through Washington, D.C. He only gave himself a couple hours layover, just enough time to stop by his dad's hospital and meet Bud Crowe.
Bud was in this hospital right by the Capitol. My dad's been a doctor there for as long as I've been alive. And I spent so many fucking hours of my life in a car waiting for my dad to finish making rounds. Like, even going back to the hospital for me was like this traumatic event of like remembering being 8 years old, like stuck in a car waiting for my dad to finish work. And so I remember like not wanting to be in there for a long time, but Bud had had a stroke. And I remember sitting in front of his hospital bed. The bed was kind of adjusted in a way where he was kind of sitting up in the bed and we were looking at each other. We talked for about over an hour and he started telling me this story about the White House plumbers and about Nixon and about hiring G. Gordon Liddy, about Howard Hunt and about a therapist in Beverly Hills. This is all stuff I had no idea about. And he told it to me in a way that wasn't funny. He was so serious. And I thought the story was the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I remember leaving the hospital room and getting on a phone call and calling someone and getting really excited about what he had told me and kind of knowing there was something there. I just didn't know exactly what it was. I met with a bunch of writers and every single writer I pitched it to wanted to do it. Every single one.
Bernad landed on a screenwriting duo named Alex Gregory and Peter Haik. Alex and Pete had written for years on Veep and were big Watergate heads. Here's Alex.
We didn't want to focus on the powerful people. That had been done, and that tends to be lots of stuffy guys in offices talking about power. And we wanted it to be more active. We had always envisioned it as a love story between Hunt and Liddy, of these two guys who had kind of been cast aside and felt like they missed their chance at greatness. In Hunt's case, he was snake bitten with the Bay of Pigs. In Liddy's case, he was sort of a washout at the FBI, a failed politician. And so by meeting each other, they saw that they had one last chance at greatness. Episode one is Hunt and Liddy like kind of prodding each other, testing each other, seeing what the other guy's made of, seeing what they're like under duress. You start to see the thaw after the first Ellsberg reconnaissance mission. They're on the plane and they're starting to fall in love, and then they have the wives meet and it goes catastrophically bad.
This framing of episode one as a love story between Hunt and Liddy, we heard the same thing from executive producer David Mandel, who directed all five episodes of the limited series.
Episode one, like all episode ones, is the hardest because you're trying to throw everyone in and explain everything without trying to bore anyone. It is the worst thing in the world to try and feel like you're trying to do. You have to sit everyone down and remind everyone a little bit of their history. Nixon is the president. Kennedy was the president before him. When Kennedy was the president, he did something called the Bay of Pigs invasion, where he didn't send air support in over the objection of the CIA and his generals. You know, you have to teach everybody this. The show always started with the second break-in attempt and the point that there were multiple attempts. And then it jumped back in time a year earlier where you met Howard Hunt.
So what is the relationship with Hunt and Liddy at the start of the series, and how does it evolve over time?
It's a bromance. It's a love story. I mean,
is that what you called it on set?
A little bit, yeah. Exactly, because it was just, there's a little bit of a meet cute, if you will, in Croak's office. And they kind of don't like each other at first. I thought I was in charge.
Maybe I'm a little confused here. Coulson told me that SIU was my op.
We don't really like each other. Black bag, black ops. You know, again, there's that sort of arc to it. And then they start to fall in love and they kind of buy into each other's nonsense.
You should have seen this guy operate.
I'm not saying nobody's kissing, let's be honest, but it is two guys that kind of fell in love. Their mutual love was Nixon. They both found in each other, this is the only guy that understands me. My wife doesn't understand me. This guy does.
Right. So I guess it's just you and me against the entire radical left.
This bromance would not have worked with just any two random Watergate dudes. Hunt and Liddy were special cases. Now, over the course of this podcast series, you're going to hear from one person who wasn't involved in the making of the White House Plumbers limited series. His name is Garrett Graff.
I am recording now.
Garrett is a renowned historian and best-selling author, most recently of the book Watergate, A New History. My producer and I turned to Garrett many times to offer some historical context around the show's events. Here he is analyzing the circumstances that sparked the bromance between Hunt and Liddy.
Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy are two people who in any other presidential administration, except for possibly the Trump era, would never get close to the White House or the president. Rambunctious bumblers with overeager imaginations who saw themselves as the last bulwark between American democracy and the collapse of society. They were two people badly out of step with the politics of that era on the streets. You have to remember how volatile this world was outside the White House gates in the early 1970s with Vietnam going on. Hunt really starts working at the White House in the spring of 71, just around the May Day protests, which are some of the largest and most violent anti-war protests in the nation's history around Vietnam. He sees the Capitol under siege. G. Gordon Liddy sort of bumped around from one government agency to another, and the two of them team up because in many ways they see themselves as kindred spirits. You know, Liddy, the former FBI agent, Hunt, the former CIA officer, both of whom have real delusions of grandeur at a certain level. People who never quite got the success in their careers that they thought they deserved, and are now being told by the White House that they are engaged in some of the most important and secret and clandestine work in the country. This, for them, both of them, is really one of the biggest breaks of their career.
The director, David Mandel, told us that one of the things that he and his team discussed at length was what motivated Hunt and Liddy. What did they want? And why?
For Hunt, this sense of striving to get it back. Right. I want to matter again. I want to be important. Death of a Salesman definitely came up because it was in there. And there was something about the clothing, the way he carried himself. There's a tiredness to Howard Hunt that I felt, and I think Woody felt, was important to kind of give life to where he was at this point in his life.
Christ, Spence, is that my legacy, working on this garbage?
When you sort of almost see him waking up in the basement in episode one, that doesn't seem like a guy that can skip. That seems like a zombie that's sort of coming to life again. This exhaustion, this sort of beaten down, the way the tie is hanging down at the end of the day, the way he's at that office and doesn't want to be there. But when things kind of kick back in, there's pep in his step and you see him come alive. It reinvigorates him. And then for Liddy, not the opposite of Howard, but how he's coming at it from a different place. He's the never was that wants what Howard had. So one guy's trying to get it back and the other guy's trying to get it.
Hello.
We got the chance to talk to Woody Harrelson about his approach to the role.
Good, good. How you doing?
He was calling in from his home in Hawaii, so the audio is a little fuzzy.
I wasn't really interested in doing a TV thing. Oh, yeah, it's not TV, it's HBO, of course. But I wasn't really interested in doing an episodic thing because I just know it takes, well, in this case, it took 6 months, you know, so that's a big chunk of your life. I said, you know, I'll look at it. And of course, you know, I read it and Pete and Alex, the writing is just superlative. So I was suddenly extremely interested. But I didn't like Hunt as a historical character. He's fairly deplorable. So I wasn't a big fan of Hunt, which kind of makes it hard to want to play him, you know. But in the end, I overcame these anxieties in the interests of just good entertainment. I think he's just this extremely smooth, very controlled character, kind of monotone, and if you listen to him talk. But I didn't really play him like that. I would do it in the mirror, and I'd just I'd fall asleep. I'm just boring myself to death, like so boring. And, you know, I'm like, what am I going to do? Like, I don't find him boring, you know, when I watch him, but somehow my imitation of him, boring, right? So I'm like, I was really struggling, and I'm like walking around my room, and just like my wife or kids probably listening to me doing lines from the thing, thinking, what is wrong with this guy? And this is the night before we started shooting. Then I started just doing like that Patton voice, the George C. Scott doing Patton, you know, wade into them, spill their blood, shoot them in the belly, you know, like that kind of voice. I just figured I'll take a little poetic license.
Woody's referring here to Patton, the 1970 biopic, which won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor for George C. Scott, who played Patton. In preparing for the role of Hunt, Woody picked up some of Patton's raspy, croaky speaking voice, sort of like I sound right now.
For the record, James Bond is a work of fiction. I am the real deal.
The ever-elusive Woody.
He doesn't have technology, so it's really hard to get him.
This is Justin Theroux. He signed on to play Liddy in White House Plumbers pretty early, and he was part of the brigade trying to woo Woody to accept the role of Hunt.
I hadn't met him. It was one of those things. I got the material from Pete and Alex, and then I was like, let's try and get Woody. And it was that classic thing of like, well, that's not going to happen. So then I just got his email and wrote him a letter. I was able to sort of start by saying, hey, I'm a friend of so-and-so, if you want to vet me. But these guys are writing this thing, and it's, I think, really funny, and it's a good sort of two-hander. And it was obviously a very hopeful, flattering letter, because I do love him. He responded, and he said, yeah, send it on. So I sent it, and he said, this is really great. Let's do it.
Liddy was also a really rich character, a guy who was constantly trying to prove himself, either through sheer daring or pathological self-mythologizing. Peter, one of the writers, said they were able to delve into Liddy's character by reading his autobiography, which is called Will.
I would say Liddy's book was one of the most insightful into his character because it was probably the most honest. It was definitely more honest than Hunt's. Hunt was an inveterate liar, and every story would be shaded with him trying to look cool, look like a spy, be amazing, whereas Liddy would be self-deprecating. He would tell really funny stories about ways that he had botched operations, or that he knew that he was ridiculous. He leaned into it, but he wasn't unaware of himself. So that kind of made him a great character to write, because he knew when he was pushing the limits of what would be normal or acceptable, and he loved his wife and his kids so much.
In order to unite these two characters, to show that they were bonded, David Mandel and the cinematographer, Steven Meisler, came up with a clever visual technique. Anytime the two guys were in the same place at the same time, they would be positioned together within the camera frame. That type of shot, a shot that includes two bodies or faces, is called a two-shot. I'll let Dave Mandel explain the significance.
There's kind of a thing we did, and now I'm getting all very cinematic, but Steven Meisler and I, this was something we talked about right from the get-go, and we copped it a little bit. We took it from a little bit from All the President's Men, which is when you watch All the President's Men, Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, Woodward and Bernstein, are almost always in two shots. Yeah. Even like when they go into an office, like when they go into Ben Bradley's office, they sit on like a small couch mm-hmm. together. And if you think about how their desks are placed, they can have one of them in the foreground mm-hmm. and then one of them is sort of like sitting like in the back but on the side, so he's in profile, one guy's mm-hmm. in the front profile. I don't think those desks actually make any sense, but it's a hell of a shot. And the point is it's always a two shot.
Explain that to me. What is the purpose of that?
Honestly, this is where it gets crazy. I think subconsciously yeah. it is to think of them as a unit. You rarely see one without the other. So go through and look when they start to meet each other, when they're in Bud Krogh's office and they're sitting across from Bud Krogh, they're in two separate chairs, and the camera at that point is kind of going back and forth between them because it's kind of like one and then the other and then one and then the other. And then finally at the end of the scene when Bud Krogh says, "I'm in charge, you guys work for me."
Right.
"Gentlemen, as per the president, I will be heading up SIU. You two will work together. You will report to me. That's the arrangement. Take it or leave it."
It's both of them together. And from that point on, they are now kind of in a two-shot land where most of the frames are always going to be them driving in a car together, maybe in the front, maybe in behind, but they're always going to be in each other's frames.
Every time we could, we would shoot it that way.
This is Steven Meisler, the cinematographer. He helped build out this visual language.
They're always in the same frame and almost framing them like one person. It's like two sides of a personality, maybe the same way that Woodward and Bernstein reported.
Meisler also used visual style cues to differentiate between Hunt and Liddy's homes.
One of our visual language techniques was with whenever we dealt with the Hunt's household was always being handheld. It's always messier compared to the other framing, which is very formal and very sleek.
"Take tonight, get some sleep. In the morning, I'll drive you back, Pumpkin."
"No, first of all, to hell with Nixon, and I'm not going back.
Keep
there. You cannot beat me.
Down.
Why? Can Nixon hear me?"
When I watched the show, I noticed straight away how cramped and chaotic it felt in Hunt's house. Mandel told me that he leaned into that atmosphere.
It felt claustrophobic in that house, and I was wondering how intentional...
Especially in his basement.
Well, yeah.
Yes. But certainly. I mean, not just the basement, but the low ceilings
the
down there.
The low ceilings.
Yes.
And just it felt
and
like...
And the way the light comes in.
You know, if you go over to a friend's house as a kid and like
that's
their dad's
the house,
fucked
that's
up.
That's not the house you want to go
right,
to.
Right. It's like, yeah. Oh man, we're all nervous in here. That yeah. is kind of how it felt to watch it.
It was very purposeful in terms of them having just how we filled the house where we kind of... It's like nice stuff, but it's seen better days. And some of it is so, it's almost like too fancy where it feels like it's pushing in on you in places. And, you know, again, trying to create this, this house you don't want to be in. And by the way, he doesn't want to be there.
Howard Hunt's house was the hardest location to find.
This is Anastasia White, the production designer. Her job was to find all of the show's locations and then oversee how they were dressed and decorated. The Hunt house was the most difficult.
We could not find the right house. And then all of a sudden we moved upstate to the Hudson Valley and we found it within a few days. It was perfect. We converted their backyard tennis court into Dorothy's stables and knocked out a bit of a wall here and there and basically just used the shell as it was. We sort of gutted their basement and then built in what we needed to make it feel like an actual basement and then built the walls around his office, which we basically created almost exactly from photographs that were online. Then Liddy, David wanted him to feel sort of poor but proud, and his house was right on the street, looks like every other house that's in his neighborhood, but... He loves it. He's proud of it. The decoration, the set deck inside of his house was more about, we thought of his wife as being more into DIY, and she would have been in charge of decorating so that some things are matchy-matchy, a lot more of the complementary colors and patterns in there.
Welcome. I'm Frances.
come in.
Kids, I want you to say hello to the Hunts.
Hello.
One of the most bombastic scenes in episode one occurs in the Liddy household. Howard and Dorothy Hunt are over for dinner, but instead of jazz, they listen to a Nazi record. And instead of playing charades, Liddy jumps out the window to chase after a neighbor kid. Justin Theroux and Woody Harrelson told us a bit about shooting the scene.
It was a long night of shooting, I remember, because it was a night shoot, obviously. And we were still trying to find the scene a little bit. We listened to the record, obviously, so we knew what we were going to be speaking over. More jarring to me was, because you just don't come across it that often, was seeing a swastika on a record and realizing this was something that was for sale.
There were times I did break up during it because it's just so funny. And he plays it just supremely well, I must say. When I started working with him, I was like, holy shit, man, this guy is swinging for the fences. I just thought what he did for the part, I can't imagine doing it better. It's wild because Liddy was, you know, I'm not saying he was a Nazi, but he definitely had some admiration for what the Nazis pulled off. Let's put it that way.
Now, we don't know if Liddy actually played a Hitler recording for Howard and Dorothy during a dinner party. But we do know that he was a Nazi fanatic.
Gordon, I have to ask, what's with the Hitler hard-on?
Alex, one of the writers, unpacked Liddy's Nazi enthusiasm.
What's interesting is, if you look at both of these guys, and if you look at their fanaticism, the through line is also trauma, is that they both suffered trauma, and it affected them profoundly. In Hunt's case, it was the Bay of Pigs. And in Liddy's case, it was childhood bullying.
Before the war, Hoboken was a pretty rough town.
He was picked on as a kid. And so that's where the Hitler fascination happened, was that his nanny would play Hitler. She was German, Frau Therese, would play Hitler's speeches on the radio. And Liddy found the voice, inspired him to be strong. And he is a peculiar character in like his rigidity, his fascination with rules and order and discipline. But somehow that bug got into him and his whole life became an overcompensation for the bullying.
In the show, Liddy suggested that he and Hunt call their secret unit Odessa.
Project Odessa.
Odessa.
Oh, yeah, new name for SIU.
We learned that Odessa actually came out of Liddy's obsession with the Nazis as well. It was an acronym for a secret network of former SS officers in the wake of World War II, a network that was in charge of helping Nazi officers escape to South America. Heavy shit. Odessa did not end up sticking, and the government cabal is ultimately called the White House Plumbers. In real life, that name has a pretty good origin story. A guy named David Young, who is not depicted in the show, was talking to his grandmother about what he was doing in the White House. "I'm helping to stop leaks," he told her. "Oh, you're a plumber," she said. And so that became their name.
Plumbers?
We fix leaks.
Oh.
Anyway, back to the double date at Liddy's house. At a certain point in the evening, Liddy jumps down from the second floor window. He's chasing some kids who threw eggs at the house. And he's brandishing a gun. The whole thing goes down in deep background while Francis, Dorothy, and Howard are sitting in the living room making awkward conversation over that Nazi record.
Oh, it's okay. Just eggs, Gordon. Just eggs. And some kids.
Those goddamn punks are back. Sorry, everybody. I'll be right back.
I asked Justin about shooting that part.
Did you actually jump out of the window?
Yes, I did. I did. Well, I mean, you know, with wires and things like that, but I did.
Oh, you were like suspended? Or?
Yeah, they had, I mean, obviously for insurance purposes, they had to have sort of a wire attached to my belt, but it was for all intents and purposes, I did jump out of the window.
How many takes?
I think we did four. It was a hard take to do because they had, you know, action and lines going on inside the room that I couldn't hear and me having to sort of drop down at the right moment, but it wasn't exactly Tom Cruise, you know, running down the Burj Dubai, but.
When Mandel was staging the scene, he knew that he wanted it to be funny, but not slip on a banana peel funny. So he decided to tread lightly.
How do you do something where you can allow something to be absolutely hilarious? A guy running upstairs, grabbing a gun, and jumping out a window and coming down. It's funny, but you don't want to hit the audience over the head with, isn't this funny? Mm-hmm. And so by it playing almost like in deep background out this window mm-hmm. as this thing going on that none of the characters are seeing and feeling, as opposed to, I guess, had we gone up with Liddy and had a camera yeah. going down with him or even from the front of the house and seeing him climb out where you're kind of going, look at this joke, look at this joke, look at this yeah. joke. There's something to just the deep background, no one sees it, that I also yeah. appreciate on a comedy level. We're in the sound mix and it was sort of like, should there be a sound when Liddy lands? These are the questions, by the way. If anybody ever wants to know what directing is about, these are the questions. You're in a sound mix. When he lands, should there be a sound? Yeah. And we tried one. You know, oh, I don't know, let's see, what does the sound look like? And the second you hear a sound, you go, oh no, they would turn their head. There can't be a sound. Because if she turned her head, the whole thing is ruined.
Now, I want to come full circle. Remember the guy who Dave Bernad met with at his dad's hospital at the top of the episode? Bud Krog?
The president feels there's been too much heel dragging on these leaks. Heel dragging and pussyfooting.
Well, the actor who ended up playing Krog is a very nice guy named Rich Sommer.
Hi, I'm Rich Sommer, and I played Egil Bud Krog.
Rich told us that he auditioned for the role of Bud Krog way back in March 2020. It was his last in-person audition before the pandemic. He was already nervous about COVID at the time, so he stole a wad of hand wipes on his way out of the office.
This was the last audition, and a full year passed between that day to them calling and offering me the role.
Did you just think, like, they're never going to make this?
Well, so much had happened in that year. Not only did I think I was never going to get it, I certainly never thought anyone was ever going to make a TV show again. I don't know. I'm a pessimist.
Rich was very knowledgeable about Krog as a character, including how to say his name, which I just couldn't figure out. Can we take it from the top?
Yeah.
Egil, like ego with an L.
Egil like an egg.
That makes more sense.
Everyone around him described him as a Boy Scout or an Eagle Scout, you know, as a real buttoned-up guy. I tried to kind of ratchet that up a little bit just because of the tone of the story that we were telling.
When you say ratchet up, what do you mean?
I mean, like, even more puckered a butthole than probably he had. I mean, just a tighter, you know, more ramrod straight maybe even than he stood. I tried to be almost robotic.
Untraceable. Call me when it's done. For God's sake, don't get caught.
My first tangible sort of interaction with anything having to do with Watergate is probably a board game. There's a great one called 1960, The Making of the President, which is about the Nixon-Kennedy race, which obviously doesn't get to Watergate. You know, one person is Nixon, one person is Kennedy. You're trying to get the electoral votes to be elected in 1960 using events that happened during that race.
Have you ever, but you've played Nixon?
I've played both sides, yeah.
Have you beat Kennedy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've won the game from both sides. I've lost the game. I've played it a bunch.
How do you beat Kennedy?
With a squeaker. I mean, you barely do it. He's a tough guy to beat. He had so much charisma.
Yeah.
You know, Nixon wouldn't wear makeup in the TV debate.
Yeah,
he looked
like shit. Yeah. I think we need to play this game.
I have a copy of my house. I should have brought it.
Rich was the first cast member to tell us about a certain pastime that some of the actors engaged in during production. It had to do with a house that Woody Harrelson had rented upstate.
Woody rented a house in New York, and I guess every morning he would get up and swim across this pond that was behind the house. He kept inviting people. So he's like, you got to come over in the morning. We're going to swim across the pond. And I kept thinking I would do it, but then I would never wake up in time because he has also a pretty early morning regimen, and it's tough for we lay people to keep up with.
Like how early?
I mean, it was, you know, 6 a.m. he was in that pond, and if I didn't have to be at work till 10, it's tough to get me out of bed. So I did wait until Woody had a little sort of end of the first week of filming gathering at his house. It was an outdoor party. And Woody told me to bring a swimsuit. So I did. There were like five of us that popped in the pond and swam across it at night. And I will also say I'm not in the shape that Woody Harrelson is in. He's a very active guy. So he was able to swim no problem. Me, I slowed down a little and he generously sort of stayed back with me as I made my way across the pond in the dark. The moon was out and we just chatted as we treaded water back across the pond. That was a lovely little evening.
Justin Theroux swam in the pond too. He seemed a little less chill about it.
You know, Woody's a bully. Let's be honest. Like, yes, I did. Woody is, you know, despite his whole kind of stoner mystique, he's a real kind of guy's guy. And that, yes, he does ridiculous things like, hey, I go swimming every morning in my freezing cold lake and I do this. So we were all at his place once. He does those things that are sort of great Santini-ish and that he'll go like, let's jump in the water right now. And it'd be like 11 o'clock at night. Summer, true, but also this is incredibly cold water. And I don't like swimming in lakes. I want to swim in things with cement bottoms. He's like a bad older brother. Like he'll be like, it only counts if you do 20 strokes out and 20 strokes back. And so the next thing you know, you're like three shots of tequila in naked and jumping in water with Woody going, why am I doing this? This is not what I do. Like, I'm not this person. I don't get and then yet I'm being somehow bullied into doing this stupid thing. Fucking Woody. You know, he's competitive. He's competitive AF.
And here's what Woody, the gracious host, had to say about it.
A lot of people went swimming in that pond. It was wonderful. It was refreshing, you know. The water's coming off the hill. I mean, it was nice and cool. And so it was a nice wake me up. Like, I've swam in it every single day. And, yeah, you know, sometimes people do get nervous about swimming in a lake sometimes. They get a little freaked out that there's creatures in there.
Next week on the White House Plumbers podcast, I'll be talking with more of the cast and crew, including the incomparable Kathleen Turner.
Somebody said to me, well, don't you realize you're a legend? And I said, no, I'm not. I've just hung in there a long time, guys.
She's a crusty, you know, crusty broad and seen it all.
AT&T had actually fomented coups, so they were dirty.
They recruit them. They have a debate among the team, you know, sort of what type of female is going to be most alluring to Democrats.
I don't, like, want people to be good-looking and funny. You know what I mean? Like, I just, that makes me uncomfortable.
Make sure to catch next week's episode of White House Plumbers on HBO or stream it on Max. Believe me, it's a fun one. The White House Plumbers podcast is a production of HBO and Campside Media. This episode was hosted by me, Olivia Nuzzi, and produced by Natalia Winkleman. Hannah Baker is our story editor. Our associate producer is Charlotte Morley. At Campside Media, our executive producer is Josh Dean. Editing and sound design by Alex Portfelix and David Devereaux. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt and Savon Slater from the HBO podcast team. Thanks for listening, and see you next time. Sorry.
No, I mean,
it's really scratchy.
No, it's fine. It's
sorry, everyone. I was out really late smoking Woody Harrelson's joint last night. He has some diabolical weed, as it turns out.